This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Dan Hallstrom, President and CEO of the U.S. Meat Export Federation. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. America's sweetest industry creates jobs and provides a sustainably produced food ingredient. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with USMEF's Dan Hallstrom next. America's 11,000 sugar beet and sugarcane farmers count on a strong U.S. sugar policy to keep American consumers supplied with an essential ingredient. Better yet, it's designed to cost taxpayers nothing. These farmers support more than 151,000 jobs throughout the sugar supply chain in both urban and rural communities. They contribute over $23 billion to the economy each year and help keep it sweet in America. Learn how the Farm Bill supports sugar crop farmers and workers at sugaralliance.org. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. The revised trade forecast for 2024 from the Department of Agriculture shows a looming $32 billion agriculture trade deficit. A strong dollar encourages imports and challenges export sales. However, Dan Hallstrom, President and CEO of the U.S. Meat Export Federation, said quality is an incentive that keeps global customers coming back for U.S. red meat.
Pork this year, year-to-date, yeah, we are definitely looking good. I mean, last year was a good year as well. But, yeah, this year, year-to-date, volume's up 6%, value's up 7%. And really, you could say on pork, we're hitting on all cylinders outside of China. And even China's up on variety meats, only down on muscle cuts. So the broad-based growth on pork is really late last year and early this year is really the story to focus on.
With regard to red meat demand, where do pork sales fall? And is the demand globally higher than it has been? And what about our competition globally?
Well, I think the demand is as good as it's been in a long, long time. When you look at the whole world and the opportunity in total, not only for pork, but for beef as well, but specifically on pork, the only part of the world that's really struggling a bit because of their own domestic supply and probably reduced consumer confidence is China. But outside of that, you look at Mexico, Central America, South America, you look at the Caribbean, you look at Asia outside of China, you know, Japan and Korea and Taiwan, and it's a pretty good story. And I would say of all those, the ones that are struggling the most is Japan, and that's because of an extremely strong dollar and also a bit of a conservative consumer. But even in Japan, we're basically steady with a year ago, and which I think is a success given the strong dollar. So, yeah, I think pork is well-positioned. Of course, you have the global shortage on beef. If you look at beef globally, led by the U.S., with our down cycle in the cattle cycle and shorter supplies, that positions pork pretty well on the global plate.
Let's turn to beef. The last numbers that I saw on sales, the volume was down a little bit compared to a year ago, but the value remained strong.
Exactly right. Yeah, through the first quarter through March, we're down about 4% on volume, but up 6% on the value, almost $2.5 billion for the first quarter. So what this tells me is, you know, the headwinds are well documented. We're all very well aware globally that we're in a down cycle because of the drought a couple years ago and liquidation on the cow side. So we're in that bottom phase of the availability of supply. We all know that. We also know that the dollar's been strong in several parts of Asia. But what this tells me is with the value up, this tells me that the global consumer understands the value of U.S. beef and still demands it and is still willing to pay for it, even though supplies are down and prices are up. So I think that's a pretty good position for U.S. beef.
Has a lower supply of beef affected our ability to sell? Have there been customers that called that we couldn't meet the orders?
Yeah, I think when you look at the volume side of things, obviously the answer is yes. But we need to put that into context. You look at products where the vast majority of the products are exported, and I'll give you an example, short plates. You know, if a plant is approved for the Asian markets, more than likely the largest percentage of those short plates are being exported because that's where the value is. So obviously, if production is down X percent, that means X percent less short plates. So in that context, yes, there's less availability. But I would say if you look at it a little broader, it's not necessarily the case because these customers, these buyers that have been partnering with U.S. companies for decades, they're well aware, they have been for years, that we were going to come into a short supply situation. So what have they been doing and what have we been doing? We've been working with a lot of these partners in the Japans and the Koreas and the Taiwans, these places on short plates, and giving them substitutions. You know, what other products can I use that can make up some of this deficit? Outside round flats, for example, sliced knuckles, things from the round which tend to be a little less utilized versus some of the middle meats or the thin meats like short plates. They're diversifying to other cuts to make up some of this deficit. So that's not all bad news because when we do come out of this cycle in a year or two, whatever the timing is where we have more production and an expansion, hopefully, we will have other options, other tools in the toolbox in terms of diversification of product mix, which will be good for all of us long term.
So this goes along with the headline of the Meat Export Federation promoting some underused cuts of meat that maybe we wouldn't have as much otherwise.
Exactly right. And the beauty of that is the buyers are willing to listen. They have to. They don't have a choice. Production's down. So they're asking us, they're asking the exporters for options. What other options are there? What other avenues to merchandise can I look at? Because I can't get enough short plates in that example. And it's working quite well. You look at a market like Taiwan that's probably outbid a lot by Japan and Korea. They've been working on this for years because they don't have all the availability that some of the other markets do. So this is nothing new for some of these markets and even the larger markets that control some of that supply of short plates, for example, like at Korea, like at Japan, they've been more than willing to look at options, and it's really paying off with increased utilization of the carcass.
The Farm Bill is a high topic in Washington and across the country, but inside that are funds that are very important to the Meat Export Federation and others that have an eye to the global market. Dan, how about the MAP and FMD funding? And is there ever really enough in this category?
Well, yeah, the MAP and FMD funding has been, and it's not just USMEF, there's 70-some cooperators in the ag community that get investment through these funds. I would say they're unbelievably important. I mean, the reach that it enables us to get, I mean, of course, you're looking at industry investments as well, you know, through the beef checkoff, through the pork checkoff. But leveraging that with government dollars, which is the whole idea, the industry leverages government dollars to make a bigger impact. We've been doing that for decades, and so a lot of our sister organizations in ag that utilize these funds have been doing the same thing. And I would argue that this has expedited the growth in these markets unbelievably. I mean, the markets would have grown anyway, but they're growing at a much quicker rate because of these investments from the industry and from the U.S. government.
A recent announcement with dollars from the Regional Agriculture Promotion Program, or RAP funds. Is there a place for those dollars that can bring an ROI?
Yes, the recent announcement on RAP, right, actually the day before our industry meeting started, they made the announcement of $300 million in the first tranche that was allocated to the cooperator community to help our investments in emerging markets especially. So when I say emerging markets, all markets are important, but specifically this gives a jump start to some of the more developing regions. Now, some examples would be Southeast Asia, the ASEAN region, markets like Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, Vietnam, also South America and Central America were two other regions of which, in our case, are growing extremely fast. And we have been putting a lot of MAP dollars into these regions, and we will continue to invest RAP dollars as well. And Africa is another one that stands out, trying to really expedite the U.S. Penetration of ag products, in our case beef and pork, into that African region. So, yeah, very, very exciting. You know, our strategy globally from a country basis has been that we need to diversify, and really diversify is not the right word. We need to expand to new regions of the world. In other words, more markets are better than less markets. And I know that strategically not being reliant on any one market is obviously a goal, but I kind of think of it as we need all markets, meaning, you know, if a China is a concern for some people, it's not for me. That market is going to be what it's going to be, and it's a very important market. But we need to be working over here on, you know, Central America. We need to be working on Southeast Asia. We need to be working on Africa. And the RAP program, as I mentioned earlier, was designed for really jump-starting some of these developing regions. And I think, and I don't think it's just on beef and pork, but ag commodities in general. Grain guys, for example, are very much involved in Africa. So I think this sort of diversification is not only smart, but strategic and long-term in thinking, and really 5-10 years down the road, I think we'll be sitting here talking about what all the great work that was done through the RAP program will yield for all of us in agriculture.
When we talk about these government funds, as you suggested, these are put together with even checkoff dollars and those from industry. Checkoff depends on the size of the herd, the number of animals. How's that fluctuation on beef and pork?
Total checkoff dollars, especially on beef, are down at the moment for obvious reasons, since it's tied to the transactions on a per-head basis. And if you have less head, it's more than likely less transactions and less budget. So this is a challenge. But overall, if you look at over many years and decades, if we can increase the international value and help increase that beef cutout, same thing on pork, I'm just using beef as the example, and we can get a higher top line value into the supply chain, the hope would be that over time this would lead to expansion and increase in numbers both on the beef herd and the pork herd, and that's really how you have to look at it. There's going to be ups and downs with uncontrollables like dry weather, like drought. But over time, the hope would be that you can grow those checkoffs over time as business expands.
Some agriculture groups and legislators have called out to the Biden administration longing for some additional free trade agreements. I'm not asking from a lobbying standpoint, Deb, but I am asking from an educational perspective. Have the FTAs that we had with South Korea, with the Dominican Republic and others, have those FTAs yielded a result?
Well, without a doubt. I'll give you a couple of examples. You look at Mexico, as part of the NAFTA originally and now USMCA. This is, and Canada too for that matter, one of our fastest growing regions over the last several decades. And in the last 2 years in particular, Mexico has been our fastest growing market on both beef and pork. In fact, last year we set an all-time record in Mexico for the year in October. So the business obviously is growing, and the fact that we have a free trade agreement, in our opinion, makes it, I would argue that the growth has been expedited. It would have probably grown anyway, but not nearly at the pace that it has. Another example that we have on our business would be Colombia. We have an FTA with Colombia. CAFTA in Central America is another one. No coincidence that these are two of our fastest growing regions. And the first market that you mentioned, Korea. You look back to, the pre-FTA with Korea when beef had a tariff of almost 40% and pork was at 25%. And look at where Korea is at today, on beef, arguably our largest market, value-wise, and, number three or four on pork. So yes. The correlation is there's definitely a correlation there, and we're seeing the benefit of it.
Of course, the administration will talk about that they have concentrated working on countries that have very large tariffs that are preventing our products from in. And you have seen results and success from lower tariffs with existing trading partners.
Yes, without a doubt. I mean, and we have, you know, we have several examples where we have relatively high tariffs, and there is business going on, but we're not at a level playing field necessarily. Vietnam, for example, stands out, where the additional, the incremental opportunity, we would argue, is much higher than what we've realized so far. So really, it's a combination of, you know, the budgets through the MAP and FMD and RAP that you mentioned, for promotion, for education, is very important. But there's also another side of the ledger, which is, having, you know, level playing field market access. And, you know, that sounds easy. It's not easy. It's very complicated. Our folks in Washington do a wonderful job of working on it, at the working level, working with SAS, for example. These folks are very good at what they do, but we do need to continue to push in some of these regions for additional access.
Dan, it would have been said over years past that the growth of the middle class was running parallel with the demand for meat globally. So if that's still the case, what are you finding of the middle class, and are there, is this creating opportunities that USMEF is really zeroed in on?
Oh, without a doubt, yeah. The middle and upper class is the focus because why? They have additional spending power. They can more easily afford to pay for quality. And when we go into a market, we're not targeting every consumer. I mean, as much as we would like to, it's just not realistic, right? When we go into China, for example, or even into a place like Korea, we are not necessarily targeting all customers because they simply can't afford it. What we are targeting is those that can afford our quality and the convenience factor. Another driver of our business globally is paying for the convenience factor. What do I mean by convenience? Home meal replacement products, restaurant meal replacement products, the meal kits that you see. Places like Costco and Walmart and these guys, they in the U.S., they have some of this product, but the percentage of these products in the foreign marketplace is much higher. Places like Korea, where up to maybe 40% of their shelf space is dedicated to these convenience products, which are much more expensive, and they're all designed to be convenient. So that's targeting a consumer that has the disposable income to pay for higher quality. So this is a trend globally, and the emerging middle class, to use or the expanding middle class might be a better way to put it, is definitely the target to really focus in on these higher value products.
How do you evaluate China from the Meat Export Federation position?
Well, I would say in general, and we have, it's two different stories with beef and pork, right? I would say in general though, it's a pretty good story. And, the reason that we're down is primarily because of pork. And what's happened on the domestic pork side in China is that, you know, post-ASF in 2020 and 2021, their herd rebuild really went over, and now they have excess inventory. It's part of their cycle. So the muscle cut business the last year, and including this year as well, is down significantly. Pork variety meats are actually up. So the business is still significant, but down, but that's the main reason why. Now flip over to beef. Beef, has been a phenomenal story for U.S. beef since 2020. And, you had the phase one agreement that went into effect in 2020 with U.S. beef and China. And, it was over a $2 billion market in 2021 and 2022. And we are a bit below last year in 2023, but still almost a $2 billion market. And the prospects for increased growth are phenomenal. That's not the case on beef. We are a unique, you know, grain-fed, very tasty, high-quality beef product that's much different than anything that they have in China. So we're really not competing directly. So I think it's a pretty good story with politics aside, pretty good story with potential for increased growth, especially on beef.
Dan, are there sanitary or phytosanitary issues that are preventing the U.S. from gaining market share? I noted recently China may have been turning back some of beef product because of the presence of ractopamine, the concern over H5N1 that has been in the U.S., primarily in poultry and in dairy. Are there headwinds from the sanitary, phytosanitary area?
Yes, there are, at a very high level. This is something that we're going to deal with more and more. And it's not just U.S. beef and pork. It's poultry. It's, you know, the grain side. I mean, everybody, the more success you have, the more that these one-off issues pop up. And you hit on two good ones. Number one, on the HPAI, the only country right now that's reacted on meat is Colombia on beef, which is totally out of line, not in line with science, and hopefully we'll be able to rectify that quickly because we do have an FTA with Colombia. But these are issues that come up, right? So they have to be addressed. The ractopamine example with China is another one that's been, we've been dealing with ractopamine on pork and beef way back to the 90s on pork. So yes, this unfortunately, the more success you have, the more these things pop up. But honestly, it's a good problem to have because we're having success, and science, honestly, is on our side. So this is where the collaboration with our government agencies, be it APHIS, FSIS, and of course FAS, who's a key partner for all of us in the export world around the world at the post level, is really, I can't stress enough the importance of that relationship on all ag products around the world.
That being said, can the U.S. spend enough or work hard enough to protect our livestock from foreign animal disease?
Well, yes. Can we spend enough and focus enough? The answer is probably no, because it's just monumentally important, right? But that being said, there is a lot of focus, both on the beef side, the pork side. I know the poultry side as well. That's not our area, but we know those folks as well. So yes, this is something. We have a reputation as being the safest food supply in the world. But you know, these issues come up, and one that nobody saw coming was the HPAI issue on the dairy cattle. It's a very good example of having to react to something that wasn't necessarily front and center, but our USDA folks put it front and center and have done a really good job of doing the best they can to not only to protect the on the animal health side, which is a necessity. But then you have to also think about what's the impact on the meat side, both domestically and globally from a consumer confidence perspective. So, yeah, this sort of collaboration between industry and the government and the FAS posts around the world is, I can't stress enough the importance of that.
Well, Dan Hallstrom, I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your busy, busy schedule following your recent conference in Kansas City. Thank you for being with us on this edition of Open Mic. Dan, it is Open Mic, and today you have the microphone for the last word.
Well, thank you, Jeff. Always a pleasure to join you, and we really appreciate the opportunity. I think that to summarize things, you know, we read a lot about all the headwinds out there. We have a strong U.S. dollar in Asia. You've got a food service sector in Asia that's still yet to rebound from COVID. You've got labor concerns. You've got concerns with China. And I agree, those are all legitimate concerns. A lot of focus on that. But I want to focus on what's going right. And I think what's going right is that we have a very high-quality product, you know, in our world, beef, pork, and lamb, but U.S. agricultural commodities, even the upstream commodities, the feedstuffs, the grain, the corn, the soybeans that go into meat production, I think we have a very good commodity that demands a premium, and we're seeing increased demand around the world. And in face of all these headwinds, the fact that we're still talking about a broad-based growth on the pork side, which undoubtedly is well on its way to a new record this year. You know, virtually all over the world there's growth outside of China. And on the beef side, in the face of a down, supply side because of the drought, at least for the next year or two, and we're still talking about increased values and demand globally, this is a great story. And there's a lot of reasons for it, but in the end, it's our product, it's our quality, it's our reputation. So the opportunity to kind of explain what's going on in the last few minutes, I can't overstate that the opportunities going forward look pretty darn good, and we're going to continue to work accordingly.
Our thanks to Dan Hallstrom, President and CEO of the U.S. Meat Export Federation, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. America's sweetest industry creates jobs and provides a sustainably produced food ingredient. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.